Please stand by. Welcome, and thank you for joining us for today's IBM teleconference, Justifying IMS Performance Tuning Tools. Today's teleconference will last approximately 60 minutes and will include a live question and answer session. This teleconference on the IMS Tools Performance Suite will discuss the valuable information hidden in logs and traces so you can pinpoint the benefits of performance tuning and ensure that these environments are performing optimally. The speaker for today's teleconference is Janet LeBlanc, IBM Tools Technical Consultant. Janet will be joining in a question and answer session later today by Mr. Jim Martin with Fundy Software. At this time, I'd like to hand the conference over to our speaker, Ms. LeBlanc. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate everyone coming to listen to me today. Today's topic is how to justify performance tools. As I've traveled across North America and Europe, visiting with various customers, one thing I have heard that has caused me some concern is the complaint that while the systems programmers and the DBAs see the value in using tools to do performance tuning, frequently they are unable to justify them. So today's call is to talk about the justification of performance tools. But really, when we start talking down this road, the base is how to justify performance tuning itself. So if we move to slide two, I'm first going to cover the legal aspects of this presentation. Within this presentation, I do have some performance studies that are in the document. These were done in a controlled lab environment, so therefore, the results in your environment may vary. So you need to verify how well the tests that we did will work in your environment. On slide three, I pose a question. Is doing performance tuning a luxury or a necessity? And this gets back to the idea of what is the cost of doing your computing? Frequently, when we have large environments that have been around for a long time, the assumption is that there's nothing that needs to be done to them. But all computing has a cost associated with it. And it's this cost that we're targeting when we do performance tuning. On slide four, what is performance? A performance problem is generally noted as bad or erratic response time or an unacceptable amount of resource usage. Historically, what this sort of thing meant was that we had something that was over a service level agreement, we were receiving complaints, or it was actually crashing our system. So rather strong, obvious situations. On slide five, when we look at what causes us to actually investigate performance problems, these are the issues that we often see. A service level objective is not being met. Now, interestingly enough, we can be meeting our service level agreement but still have the second topic come up, users complaining about slow response. Users view slow response as being anything that's slower than what they're used to getting. They could still be meeting the service level agreement, but when they see a big difference in the response, complaints can come in. So unsatisfied customers can be a problem. Unexpected changes in response times or resource utilization. So suddenly seeing a difference in the response time or seeing a jump in how much resources are being taken for an existing transaction are a sign that something needs to be checked. The ZOS operating system is showing signs of stress. The throughput on the system is erratic. Changes in workload, which were not anticipated. Now, this is a classic. We have transactions that are in our system that have been running for quite some time, and then a decision is made to open this transaction up using, for example, IMS Connect, and suddenly the amount of workload doubles, triples, quadruples. And certainly when the decision was made to move to IMS Connect, there was some projections done for what could be expected. However, in that type of dynamic environment, the demand can greatly exceed what was expected to occur. And then changes in the profile of transactions. On slide 6, what are the causes? What things can affect our performance? ZOS tuning, changing the priority of your IMS environment. Things affecting your IMS TM or CICS environment. And then the database, so DBAs making changes, or perhaps things that have been defined for a long time that are causing performance issues. Application programming. Now, granted, most of our IMS applications haven't been amended in quite some time, but that doesn't mean that they're performing at optimum stage. And then I have another category here called application environmentals. An application program is written and put into production, but what can affect the application is also things such as the JCL, the buffers. All of those aren't part of the actual application code, but they do affect the performance of that application. And then, of course, hardware and our network throughput. On slide 7, gets back to the core reason that this presentation was put together. Why is performance tuning at the application or the database level not happening anymore? We're frequently doing performance tuning of the transaction manager, but we're not looking at the database, and we're not looking at the application. And the reason is that because these applications are static, there's no changes occurring. And maybe we are actually meeting that service level agreement. So performance is, quote, okay. And there's a feeling that because these are static applications, there's no need to spend money on them. So there's no money for special performance tools. And as time has gone by, we have found that the technical expertise to do performance tuning has atrophied. We either have no one who knows how to do it at all, or due to people retiring and gradual reductions in the number of staff assigned to maintaining an IMS environment, we don't have those capabilities. So there's no time to do the performance tuning. We're busy doing just the mundane work. Major rewrites aren't possible. The idea of having an application programmer rewrite an IMS application is just not possible. And the view seems to be that if you can't rewrite the application, there's no point trying to do performance tuning. But that is really not the case. The reality is that there's so many, many things that can be done to improve the performance of an IMS application without touching the calls of that program. Comes down to this. Everything is running. Nobody cares. Why should they care? On slide 8, why should we really be still doing application tuning? There is still change happening. You're getting new software releases affecting the application. You've got new versions of IMS. new versions of ZOS. The transaction volumes are dramatically increasing. The data volumes are increasing, which affect how the databases perform. With web enablement of transactions, we're introducing new stresses to your IMS applications. And let's think about this. If I could tell you that you can get a 20% reduction across the board of your IMS CPU usage, would somebody be interested? I think so. Because delaying the purchase of new hardware to be able to deal with new growth is a major cost saving. Because it's not just the cost of the hardware, but also the cost of the software in order to support that hardware. And let's be realistic. Were the applications that were written 20, 30 years ago really that well written to begin with? Those applications and the database design decisions were based on old releases of IMS and based on what was considered optimal design at that time. However, many of those things and many of those recommendations have changed and should be revisited. So remember, if I can suggest to you one small change that can deliver 18 to 40% CPU time improvement, would you be interested? Let's look now at slide 9. Okay, so now the next problem. You tell me that you don't have the tools that you need and you don't have the time. And even worse, you do not have management support. And without management support, you're not going to get either of the other two. So how do we resolve this issue that management does not understand the value of doing IMS performance tuning? On slide 10, we get back to our little circle here. What are the things that are important to your management? Number one is money. Reducing the cost in your IT environment is always important. If there's ways to be able to reduce how much things are charged for, there's value in that. People. With the reduction in staff, being able to do more with less people is in some ways a money issue, but also can be an issue as far as skills. Customer satisfaction. Not having their phone ring because performance is down. Not having abandons. Not meeting those service level agreements. Keeping availability as close to 100% as possible. Those are the three areas that are most important to senior management in an IT organization. On slide 11, so if you don't have management support, your bottom line is usually money. If you can figure out a way to prove to your management that doing performance tuning is going to save money, you're going to get some interest. Elapsed time is another area that can be of value, but again, it's dependent on what are the important things to your management, what things are of value. The trick when you're doing this is that you're entering the world of politics, and nobody likes playing the politics game, but the reality is you want people on your side. And in order to do that, it means you have to start looking beside you. You have to start looking at the other people in your organization at probably the same level you're at, but with different management. In order to get the support so that when your request goes up the chain and they start investigating this possibility that they're going to hear supportive comments from other people in the organization. So first of all, your capacity planner. Capacity planning, their whole focus is when do we need the next upgrade? When do we need the next mainframe? And if the projections, current projections, are showing that it's relatively imminent, they're going to be interested if you've got an idea that may delay it for a year or two. Next thing is, who's paying the bills? How are the bills paid for? Is it real money? Are you outsourced to an outside vendor and you actually get charges if you're for your CPU time or your EXCPs? What is the basis of the bill? Knowing that can tell you that if you're charged based on CPU time and you can reduce your CPU time by 20%, you've saved a big chunk of money. On slide 12, so it gets down to know your organization, get sponsors, talk to your users, find out if they have any issues, or if they're paying the actual bill, they're probably going to be interested if you can save them 20%. So look at your parallel organizations, your users, your capacity planners, and bring people on side prior to meetings. Go out for a coffee. Have a chat. Find out what's important to them. On slide 13, I told you you had to find the money. So you had to be able to say, I can potentially improve the CPU time by 20%, 30%, 40%, whatever. So you need to look at, where are your performance opportunities? So what's the potential improvement? CPU time, elapsed time, perhaps processes that are no longer needed because of some performance tuning that you do. The trick and the most important value here, though, is you need to make sure that you can track what the performance statistics were prior to your performance tuning, and then after, so that you can go back and say, as a result of doing this performance tuning exercise, we got these results. That will then be the basis that you will use to be able to justify future performance tuning projects. Doing a proof of concept of performance tuning to justify the time and expense. A small little project that doesn't take much of your time to be able to show that in your environment that this performance tuning would be advantageous. On slide 14. Okay, now you need some time and some tools. And reality is, yeah, you can do it without tools. But that means you need lots of time and lots of people. And the next question is, when's the last time you were reading HEX, and how good is your skill at that? So what tools give you is the ability to buy some time and accuracy. And these days, with fewer people and less time available, that is important. Well, the next thing that can often come up when we start talking performance is, but I have a monitor. And what we need to remember is, a performance monitor, such as a Megamon or other companies' versions of an active monitor, is that it's designed to find the hot things, the critical issue that is occurring right now, this minute. What we're trying to look at is trends. We're trying to find that building problem that doesn't look like it's a real problem, but that we can, with tuning, reduce it down so that we have some real value. On slide 15, as you're going through this process, trying to justify buying the tools, every time that you're going to get a roadblock, you're going to have to move yourself back up to showing the value, showing the money. Because there will be roadblocks in this process. The roadblocks may not be the financial part of buying the tool. You could then get roadblocks such as users saying, no, we can't give you the access to the database. We can't handle the downtime. Being able to get over these roadblocks is being able to go and present to them what the benefit to them will be. And it's really important to always put yourself in their shoes. What are the things that are important to the person you're talking to? Each person in your organization are going to have different things that are important. Your user is going to be concerned with availability, but they're also going to be concerned with cost. Your capacity planner is concerned with when is the next time they need to upgrade the hardware. So depending on who in the organization you're talking to, you need to present things a little differently. On slide 16, we talk about what monitoring tools are available. IMS itself does provide for some capabilities in monitoring. There is the IMS monitor that will capture statistics for you and be able to print them off. Also, to be able to get at the statistics that are contained within the IMS log, there's the File Select Formatting Print Utility, DFS-SARA-A10, which for those that have had experience using this utility, this is where you get lots of practice with your hex coding skills. The Log Transaction Analysis Utility. And now there's the Knowledge Base Log Analysis that is able to format the CSECs of the log so that they're in a more readable format rather than having to brush up on your hex skills. In addition, we offer a number of tools, and certainly other vendors do also. IMS Performance Analyzer is the premier tool that can be used to read the log, read IMS Connect data, and provide very formatted, merged reports to give you the statistical information you need to do trend analysis and to investigate early problems. Tivoli's Omegamon XE for IMS is your active monitor. It also has the ability to be able to store historical data that you can then use to be able to also look at some of the statistics. IMS Connect Extensions is a product that will capture the activity that's actually occurring in IMS Connect. Otherwise, we have a black box situation in that we have the TCP/IP request coming in. It goes into IMS Connect. Who knows what happens then? And then we branch to the IMS transaction. And we have all the statistics we need on what happens in the IMS transactions, but we don't know what's going on in IMS Connect. IMS Connect Extensions externalizes that into log-like files that can then be merged as part of with the logs with IMS Performance Analyzer. IMS Problem Investigator is a way of investigating specific problems using the log and IMS Connect data. Very easy to use ISPF type interface. IMS Buffer Pool Analyzer is a tool for predicting what changes would do if you were to change your buffers for either your batch applications or your online applications and what you can expect to occur. In addition, it will give actual recommendations as what the ideal level for those buffers would be. IMS High Performance Pointer Checker provides for statistics on what's happening actually in the database, what's the state, how much free space is available, so that you can make decisions on tuning your database. On slide 17, we're going to start going now into what kind of monitoring methodology you should look at doing. The contents of this presentation is based on a new red book that came out in December 2006, IMS Performance and Tuning. And I will have the list of how to get that red book at the end of the presentation. All I'm doing in this presentation is just touching on some of the higher level points that are in that book. You definitely want to go use that book in detail if you want to do performance and tuning. On slide 18, the first area that we deal with when we're doing performance is defining that service level agreement. They probably already exist in your organization. What a service level agreement normally has is what is acceptable response time for the business, what is the expected volumes of transactions, and what's anticipated for a growth for those volumes, and some details about the transactions and their usage. On slide 19, also what's done is defining the transaction profile. So what kind of transaction is this? So from a host response time, what's the input queue time measurement, the total elapsed time measurement, how much CPU is normally required to process these transactions, how many database calls are performed, and when we're looking at the type of databases calls performed, we want to see by database and the type of call. So are these gets, are these updates, inserts, deletes, and how many IOs are required to perform this transaction. This information is captured frequently for the benefit of the capacity planners because it allows them to take a look at equal types of transactions. So if a new application is coming in and it's viewed to be the same profile as another one, it gives them a basis to be able to predict the usage for that new transaction. On slide 20, the next area is tracking and trending. It's needed to be able to track and trend your workload. This is done partly for the capacity planning purposes in order to figure out what the future requirements are going to be. And often in an organization, they'll have a full-time performance expert handling this area. But what you often tend to see is these people look at things at an extremely high level. They're not looking down as to what can be done to actually make things better than what they are today, remembering that frequently today is okay. On slide 21, so really the step from your perspective would be, first of all, what is our objective? What are we trying to accomplish? Examine the application design performance objectives and measure the application. Have the objectives been met? If the answer is yes, document the status quo. If not, identify the problem areas. Do we need more information in order to try to figure this out? If the answer is yes, we need more information, we have to figure out which tool is it that's going to provide us that information. Then take corrective actions. And then, as I said earlier, one of the most important things is remeasure the application to document what improvements occurred. And go back to step number 3, have we met the objectives we were trying to do? When we're looking at objectives, remember that this could be throughput-oriented or response time-oriented, or as we also mentioned, CPU time. But they have to be precise. You have to know what you're trying to accomplish. On slide 22, what do you need to be able to do this? You need those baseline statistics and historical statistics. And you need to look at it at different times. It's not enough just to look at from a global point of view of a transaction, but you also need to look at what kind of performance statistics are you getting during peak load, during quiet times. And here's another thought, getting the same statistics just after you've done a database reorganization, at the point where the database is in optimal state. And we'll get to a little later why that there's a value in knowing that. And, of course, as I've mentioned and I'll keep mentioning, before and after performance tuning so that you can capture the value of doing this work. Current statistics, application details, understanding the applications that are accessing these databases. What is the purpose of them? What are they trying to do? And your database definition. How do you have this database defined? What type of access method are you using? Slide 23, I mentioned earlier that Performance Analyzer is often the tool that's used for this purpose. Performance Analyzer provides for daily monitoring, has a dashboard that you can customize to show the information that you would like to see, provides for transit response time reports, management exception reports, and this is an area quite often that will be set up to come up with information on things that are not meeting service level agreements. If you do have a performance problem or you would like to see whether or not you can get some improvements, you can drill down to more reports. If you're trying to improve response time, you can look at the transit reports. If there's resource constraints, look at the resource utilization reports. And for long-term capacity planning and service levels, there's a transaction history file that will track daily transaction performance. You can also export and load into DB2 to build yourself a performance database. And these reports can be done on the host or on a workstation using whatever SQL reporting tool you'd like. On slide 24, I'm mentioning something new that's coming with IMS version 10, and that's a new log record, the 56FA log record. And there'll be one record per transaction rather than per schedule. And additional information will be provided in this record. There'll be OSAM and VSAM read and write counts, database I/O counts and elapsed times, database lock elapsed times, external subsystem call counts, and unit of recovery elapsed and CPU times. IMS Performance Analyzer is already able to report on this new log record type. On slide 25, and a few slides I have here, it's just on some sample reports that are available with Performance Analyzer. Slide 25 is showing a sample transaction dashboard. You can summarize it based on any criteria. In this example, I'm showing it by region type. The statistical functions that are available include both average and peak percentile. Slide 26, just showing here, a transit analysis report showing the total response time and the time that's spent in the various stages of the transaction, pre-OTMA, socket reads, the OTMA time, and then the output. Slide 27, summary report of transaction activity statistically summarized by TransCode. And as you move to IMS version 10, once it becomes generally available, version 10 is introducing microsecond precision. So now on slide 28, what I'm now going to do is I'm going to review a number of the performance hints and tips that you're going to find in the Red Book on performance and tuning. There is no way possible on this call that I have the time to go through all of the intricacies, but I'm going to try to give you a flavor for what value you can find by reviewing this book. On slide 29, IMS on-demand performance. We've done some performance tuning tests comparing SNA with TCP/IP. And what we have found in our testing is that TCP/IP clearly is outperforming SNA, which is contrary to what the general feeling was. And just to assure you that moving to TCP/IP is probably a very good move. On slide 30, an IMS performance analyzer report showing the combined IMS and IMS Connect summary, showing that we will merge both the log data concerning the IMS transaction with the IMS Connect extensions data, giving you an end-to-end report. On slide 31, taking a look at programming right now. And while you may not be doing a lot of programming, this is certainly still worth being aware of. There are some things here that don't actually affect the actual performance coding, but if you are coding a new program, that to reduce the number of DLI calls, you should be using path calls. Of course, we want to eliminate any redundant calls. And before we kind of laugh at that one, I can recall doing a performance tuning of an application that was taking an inordinate amount of time to do some deletes in the database. And when I got the report of the actual calls of the program, I discovered that after a delete, the programmer was doing a get unique of the segment that they had deleted. And, of course, that took a huge amount of time. They were apparently not trusting the return code from the delete. After removing that get unique, the time dropped by 90%. So don't assume that things are done properly. Use single segment input messages and send single segment output messages. In order to reduce the number of I waits, use fully qualified calls. Use the index field name in an SSA when the PCB has a proc seek. And here's an interesting one. Do not use procop equals GOT. Instead, you should be using procop equals GON. Now, the difference here is that, first of all, let's remind you of what a GO does. If I have procop GO, what that's telling IMS is that I want to do only reads. However, if updates are occurring, I could get an append due to updates occurring in progress. What GOT did for us was cause IMS, when it would have that occur, go back and try again. But if it failed again, it would, at that point, return a return code of GG. So you still had the situation of a failure. What GON will do for you is accept the data as it is and not cause you either an append or a return code. So if it doesn't matter if the data has changed slightly, then GON is better performing. The next item is for the batch programs that still may be around if you have an offline process. And using DBB in production, the difference between DBB and DLI is where it gets the PSB and DBD information. If you're using DLI, that means you're coding both your DVD Live and your PSB Live in your JCL. And we have to do the build. DBB uses the ACB Live and saves the performance hit of having to build the combined information. On slide 32, another way to improve application program performance. If you have programs that all they're doing is reading the database and they're reading sequentially because they're doing this report, or you have programs that are loading the database, so you're doing an application load, in both circumstances, you can increase the performance dramatically of these two types of applications by getting a utility assistance. So, and this is without having to make any changes to the actual application. The change is strictly in the JCL to reference the utility libraries. On slide 33 are some statistics from some testing that we did from doing a read application. And what we found with the read application, the elapsed time was 3.3 times faster, and CPU was 1.8 times less CPU time. In the case of the load application, the elapsed time improved by 9.1 times faster, and CPU was 2.6 times less CPU. So not only did we improve the elapsed time, but we decreased the amount of CPU that was needed for these application programs. On slide 34, some logging performance tidbits. And this is performance that gets reflected in the DLI, not iWait time. Making database buffer subpools large. Use vSAN background write. Define databases as unrecoverable. So, for example, if currently you have indexes that are normally rebuilt using an index building tool, defining those databases as unrecoverable will certainly save on your log. Using 24K or 28K blocking, this is going to allow for your old buffers to be placed in real storage. And above the 2 gig bar by being multiples of 4K. On slide 35, I'm listing here all the different things that are in the book on how to do database performance. I'm only going to touch on a few of these, and even that at a high level. So now we're on slide 36, looking at database access methods and how that can affect performance. When you're choosing an IMS access method, you need to look at what kind of processing is going to be done. And we put these in order of what the preferred order would be. So if all the access is direct, so you're providing a key, then the ideal is to use DEDB for performance, then HDAM, then HiDAM or HiSAM. For sequential, now this is going to be interesting because most of you are going to say, oh, sequential, that must be HiDAM. No. What do we have here? DEDB or HDAM. But in brackets, I have sequential randomizer. So what that is doing is giving you the speed of using a randomizer. So you're not having to read an index, but you're using DEDB or HDAM, and the data is all stored in sequential order. Then, of course, after that would be HiDAM and HiSAM. If you have a mixture of processing, then again, the same as above, the ideal is to have DEDB or HDAM. Now, in all cases where I'm saying HDAM or HiDAM, the preference is to use HALDB, so PHDAM and PHIDAM. Remember, all the future development is going to be in that area. Next question, is the data volatile, constantly changing? Well, then you want to be sure that you're using a DDB or an HD database. Do they vary in length? Are there logical relationships needed? Then we're dealing with HD. Are secondary indexes needed? So again, we're dealing with an HD database, HDAM or HIDAM. And is there a need for a journaling capability? In that case, then we were looking at DDB. On slide 37, the next area would be the block or CI size. If you have large CIs or blocks, this is going to improve your sequential processing. It's going to reduce the number of I weights. It'll increase the I weight time per I weight, but it will decrease the total I wait time. On the other hand, smaller CIs or blocks would improve random processing, increase the number of I waits, but reduce the I wait time per I wait. So it's one of those classic, it depends. It depends on what you need to have in your environment. Now looking at free space tidbits, if you get your free space right, this can dramatically reduce the number of reorgs you need to do. So in order to get your free space right, you have to understand how the database is being used, where the updates are occurring. So first, if the database is totally static, no additions occurring, you don't need free space at all. So get rid of it. If you only have a few additions, either no free space or just a little bit of free space in the CI. If it's evenly distributed additions, free space in the CA or free space in both CI and CA. Unevenly distributed additions, just put a small amount of free space. Now the cost of free space, DASI, which we all understand that, but you also have the situation of additional I.O. when you're doing sequential processing. So if you're doing a lot of sequential processes, you may not want to have a lot of free space and additional number of indexed records. On slide 39, looking at pointers, using child and twin pointers instead of hierarchic pointers, some of these are things that you should already know and hopefully have implemented. Do not specify twin backward pointers for dependent segments. Never specifying twin forward only pointers for HIDAM, and never specifying twin forward and backward pointers for HDAM routes. Specify no twin for HIDAM and PHIDAM routes. And if you specify rules last or use last as the default for your segments without sequence fields, you should define a physical child last pointer from the parent if there might be a long twin chain. Looking at slide 40, compression tidbits, the things to consider is that this is going to improve your DASI space usage. You're going to be able to get more data in a block. So when you read that block, you'll have a larger number of segments available in the buffers. So this is going to improve your buffer space utilization. As a result, may reduce your IOs. It will increase your CPU time unless you're using hardware data compression, because then the CPU time is in the hardware component. Slide 41, here's my magic bullet. It has been said, not sure if it's right or if it's wrong, that 50% of the customers are using OSAM for their data and 50% are using vSAM. And that this is an area where there's been a lot of controversy over the years as to which is the best way to go. And the OSAM people are adamant that theirs is right and the vSAM people are adamant that theirs is right. So we did some testing. We did some controlled environment testing using 10 HIDAM databases. The first set of tests were run with databases defined with vSAM. And the second set of tests were run with OSAM, using the exact same workload that was used in the first test. The first test was three BMPs, each executing 2 million total database calls. There were 10 qualified get-hold unique calls performed with 1 million qualified get-hold next calls and 1 million replace calls. The next set of BMPs that we did were 4 BMPs, each executing 4,500,000 total database calls. There was 1 qualified get-hold unique performed with 1 million qualified get-hold next calls, 1,000 replace calls, and 4 million get next calls. Now, are you all there waiting, wondering whether your way is the best? Let's go look at slide 42. Okay, what is clear, absolutely clear, is OSAM is the winner, and dramatically a winner. In the first test, BSAM versus OSAM, there was a 19% reduction in CPU time, a 27-28% reduction in elapsed time. The second entry is for sequential buffering, so, and that changed the statistics a little bit. BMP set 2. It got even more dramatic. So the difference when CPU time for OSAM versus VSAM, there was a 41% reduction in CPU time and a 35% reduction in elapsed time. But with the sequential buffering, we saw since this particular BMP set had a lot of get-next processing, we saw even better improvements in our elapsed time and reached almost 79% reduction. So these are the kind of stats that will catch people's attention. And it's not a major change to your application. So on slide 43, why did we get these results? OSAM writes multiple blocks. When it's writing multiple blocks, it first sorts by the physical location and then does chain writes in parallel. There's a shorter processor instruction path length with OSAM, the sequential buffering available with OSAM, and, of course, the value, the other, one of the values of OSAM data sets is that you can go up to 8 gigabytes. Also, the reuse of OSAM data sets. On slide 44, we're going to now take a look at buffering. And here's another cheap performance tuning. Changes to the buffers for applications can be done without a reorg and without an application change. Sounds easy, but the big question has always been how and how much. The criteria that we need to look at is a concept called a buffer life concept. The other thing that we need to think about is user think time. So what we want to have occur is that the data needs to stay in the buffer during the time that the user is thinking. So we're dealing with an online transaction. The end user is doing some work. So how much time do we actually need to allocate to make sure things stay in the buffer? The next question is, that comes up is, I may have figured out I want something to stay in the buffer a certain amount of time, and I'm thinking about making some buffer pool changes. But how do I know that I'll actually get any improvement? And should my amounts be going up or down? And if it's going up, by how much? And maybe I think this one database is a really heavy hitter. Maybe I'm considering moving that database into its own subpool. Well, what will that do to all of the statistics? So here's an area where the tool that we suggest is Buffer Pool Analyzer. On slide 45, I'm just showing a couple of the reports. First of all, here's a database subpool summary report showing you the existing information. And then on slide 46, projections. So what would happen if I actually changed the number of buffers? And letting you know at what point that you no longer have any value. So the buffer life information is provided. And a column at the far right, the marginal reduction, which tells you at what point you no longer have any benefit. So there's no point increasing. So once we get down to zero, any increases in buffers is going to give you no benefit at all. Slide 47, reorganization. I mentioned early on that it was important to capture statistics before and after a reorg. And the reason we want to do this is so that we have another way of seeing when we need to do a reorg. Because really, the most important reason for doing a reorg is because performance of the applications are being affected. Classic reasons that we've taken in the past, though, have been things such as extents, which may or may not have been a problem. Free space statistics, maybe. CI and CA splits. And then in the case of HDAM, percentage of the roots in the home block. But the question can be, is the area of the database that's out of order or out of sync actually accessed by the applications? If it's not, then it may not even be affecting the applications. So gathering statistics post-reorg so you can compare to your current scenario, you can see then when application performance is deteriorating, whether you're getting too many physical IOs to DASD. On slide 48, throughout this presentation, I've referenced the IMS Performance and Tuning Guide. This was released on December 2006, and the code for the book is SG247324-00. Go to the Red Book site or to the IMS site to get more information about this book, and ideally you can just download it and be able to access it at no cost. If you actually want to purchase a physical copy, that is also feasible. Slide 49, just for your own interest, I've put a little bit of technical trivia. We all know about terabytes, but I thought we might want to know, as we grow in our environments, what are the terms that one should use, and let's hope that we never get to the point where we're talking about vundabyte databases. On slide 50, one of the things as we do these conference calls is we're always trying to look at what kind of information would be of value to you. What would you like to hear on these calls concerning the IMS tools or IMS areas? Please feel free to drop me a line, LeblancJ@ca.ibm.com. I'm interested in your input. Or you can contact Sally Tuscany at tuscany@us.ibm.com. Or you can actually give Sally a call and have a discussion about what kind of thing you would like to see on these regularly scheduled calls. And at this point, we can go to the question and answer. And with me today, I have Jim Martin, who's a specialist on the IMS Performance Analyzer. So if you have any questions on that specific topic, he'll be here to also answer questions. Thank you.
And thank you, Janet. But now, actually, at this time, we'd like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Now, right after the survey, we will have a live question and answer session with our presenter. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. Now, to participate, simply press the star key followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Now, please listen to all options before making your selection. Let's get started. Question 1. Please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. And if it was low, press star 3. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to answer. Question 2. How was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference? If it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. And if it was more technical than I needed to hear, please press star 3. Question 3. What version of IMS are you currently running? If it is version 9, press star 1. Version 8, press star 2. And for version 7, press star 3. Once again, we'll pause for just a moment. Moving on to question 4. Are you looking to upgrade to IMS 10 in the near future? If within the next 6 months, press star 1. If in 12 months, press star 2. If not considered, press star 3. Once again, those responses, if in the next 6 months, press star 1. If in 12 months, star 2. If not considered, star 3. And finally, question 5. Now, we hope you have enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you're interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If yes, please press star 1, and if no, star 2. Now, that does conclude our survey, and we do thank you for participating. Now, we'd like to move on to our questions. Now, to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone. Once again, that is star 1 to ask a question. At this time, I'll turn the call conference back over to our speaker while we wait for questions.
Thank you, everyone, for joining this call. While I wait for some questions, just wanted to let you know that Jim Martin was unable to join the call, so you will be just talking to me, the speaker, Janet LeBlanc.
Thank you, Ms. LeBlanc. And once again, for our participants, if you would like to ask a question, simply press the star key followed by the digit 1. And we'll pause for just a moment. And we have no questions at this time, Ms. LeBlanc. I'll turn the conference back over to you for additional or closing remarks.
Well, I appreciate everyone who has joined this call today. I hope it was of value to you. And as I noted near the end of the presentation, we are definitely very interested in knowing what kinds of presentations and what kind of information you would like to see in future calls. Looking forward to hearing from all of you. Thank you.
That does conclude today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. Have a great day.